Welcome to this podcast from Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. This podcast is made possible through support from the members of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about events or membership, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum or join us on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I'm Catherine Moskowski, senior writer for Salon.com. Naomi Wolf is a political consultant, a progressive advocate, a feminist, and an author. First known for her breakout book, The Beauty Myth, Wolf has been a political consultant to Bill Clinton and Al Gore and has never been afraid to rock the boat. Most recently, Naomi Wolf has come to champion personal freedoms in her books, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, and Give Me Liberty, a handbook for American revolutionaries. She cries out against what she sees as the encroachment of fascistic government policies into the private lives of American citizens and tells us what we can do to stop it. Tonight, we will talk about her clarion call to the American public and more. Please welcome Naomi Wolf.
Thank you.
You recently called for the arrest of President George W. Bush. Could you? Could you explain why?
Sure, Catherine, and let's just start slow, shall we? I think this is a very good moment to explain why. George Bush has, I mean, this is not a rhetorical gesture on my part at all. George Bush and the people around him, certainly Rumsfeld and Cheney and Condoleezza Rice, have committed three categories of crimes, apparently, according to the Center for Constitutional Rights. But quite apart from those crimes, which include violating U.S. and international laws on torture and engaging in illegal war, they also, quite extraordinarily, as of October 1st, have essentially commissioned a coup in the sense that George Bush deployed the 1st Brigade of the 3rd Infantry Division from Iraq, where they were engaged in crowd control and the subjugation of Fallujah, to the streets of the United States of America. They are somewhere in the United States. We don't know where. And this is a dictionary definition of a police state when the leader has his own army, his own military. This is 3,000 to 4,000 soldiers who are not answerable to the governors. They're not answerable to you and me. They're not answerable to Congress. They are answerable up the chain of command to the President of the United States of America. His deploying military to the streets of the United States is a violation of 200 years of first the Insurrection Act of 1807, which drew a bright line, the founding generation drew a bright line between military and civilian policing because they knew how easy it is to subjugate a population when there's a standing army in their midst, not answerable to the people, King George III's mercenaries who are breaking into their homes, terrorizing women and children, seizing their stuff without warrants. But it's also a violation of the 1879 Posse Comitatus Act, after the Civil War, which again made it absolutely certain that military would never be deployed on our streets. And George Bush ignored, with a signing statement, legislation in 2008 to limit his ability to deploy troops, and now he's done it. And between that and the proposed $100 billion in discretionary spending for the president in the bailout bill, with no oversight, you know, technical definition of a police state is the president has his own army and his own treasury. And so, you know, a dictionary definition of a coup is when there's a sudden change in the form of government, and that is what we now have. So this is treason. It is a violation of everything that our system is supposed to be. It's a complete usurpation of the checks and balances that the founders have put in place. And history, which I've studied carefully for The End of America and Give Me Liberty, shows that people who are willing to do this and the other illegalities and crimes that they've committed, it is simply not safe to leave the country in their hands not only through an election process, but till Inauguration Day, and that the only way to stabilize this country is to arrest and prosecute these criminals, and if they're guilty, put them in jail.
So how would anyone go about arresting the president? Like, what would the process be?
Yeah, well, this is, I mean, you're how can I put this? I would love to, I just can't, you know, so sometimes I have these conversations and I think, where are we? You know, is this the Soviet Union in 1985? You know, is this Iran? I mean, is this the United States of America in 2008? How do you go arresting the president when he's deployed troops on the street? I can tell you because it's a very important question. Now, first, you know, I guess what I want to urge you to consider is that the habits of democracy involve our sitting around going, oh my God, these bozos. You know, can you believe it? No one will stand for this. Surely someone will do something. Surely the ACLU will take some sort of action. Those habits of democracy are very dangerous right now. We are no longer living in democracy time. Democracy time is deliberative, it's slow, it's funny, there's room for discussion and frustration and, you know, turning away from the discussion to go internet shopping and, you know, we don't have that kind of time right now. We have to understand that we're facing a dictatorship. You know, and again, how can I use this language? I'm not saying something that hasn't been in process for 8 years. You know, for 8 years, each of these 10 steps that I warned about in The End of America, the invocation of an internal and external threat, the creation of secret prisons outside the rule of law where torture takes place, the establishment of a paramilitary force, the establishment of a surveillance society, all the way to step 10, which is making it easier for the leader to declare martial law or the subversion of the rule of law. All of these steps which dictators put in place to close a democracy are in place now in the U.S. So we have to understand that we're facing a much more catastrophic and urgent need for action than we're used to having to deal with in democracy time when we can all just change the channel. All right? So how do you arrest the president? It is not a hypothetical because history shows that the only thing that is called for right now to really keep us from extremely serious further crushings of our liberty, which start to get into, you know, they start to move into much more personal kinds of jeopardy. The only way to fight that is for many, many millions of people, wherever they're situated in their personal or professional lives, to say no in many, many kinds of ways. So let me quickly answer your question. How do you arrest the president? Well, it turns out that these people are quite brilliant because, like the National Socialists, everything the Nazis did was legal, right? It wasn't an illegal coup. It wasn't a violent coup. The National Socialists set out in a parliamentary democracy to use the law to subvert the law. You know, everything from Clause 2 and in the Enabling Acts that drove a freaked-out parliament in the wake of a hyped terror threat to pass laws enabling the state to listen in on phone calls of the German people, open their mail, does this sound familiar, open their telegrams, to pressure on parliamentarians to give up their own powers under the Constitution to the executive, does this sound familiar? Everything they did was legal. So I believe Karl Rove, and I cite plenty of evidence for this, has studied Nazi Germany and Mussolini's Italy, and many other closing societies or closed societies. And he's reproducing systems of subversion of the law. So everything these people are doing is legal because they changed the laws to make it legal. So now the 1st Brigade cannot say, I am not going to bear arms against my fellow American citizens because they would be facing arrest and 5 years in prison because they are not free to disobey legal orders. They're free to disobey illegal orders, okay? So given that everything these people have done is now legal, how do you arrest the president? Congress can't do it. The Pentagon can't do it. The only people who can arrest the president, according to Vincent Bugliosi and other people who studied this, right now are district attorneys, who have the power, if he's impeached, if he's no longer in office, to arrest him. And Bugliosi, who's a prosecutor, set up a very persuasive case for prosecution of George W. Bush for murder, where he said that any attorney, U.S. attorney, I beg your pardon, any district attorney in a region of the country where a soldier has died can prosecute George Bush, can arrest George Bush. And I've been trading calls with Charlotte Dennett, who is running for a DA in Vermont, who has promised that if she's elected, the first thing she's going to do is arrest George Bush. But I just want to kind of conclude by saying, do you understand that when I say, well, we've just talked about arresting the president, but each of you is going to be called to be able to say no in multiple ways in your own lives, whether or not it has to do with are you in the chain of people who can arrest the president. What I mean is this. History shows that when many citizens rise up at once in their own capacities to say no, there is almost no power on earth that can suppress that. And so, for instance, I'm so moved by individual patriots I'm hearing about right now who are saying no, wherever they're situated, because this is our salvation, and this is really our only salvation. For example, there were police officers in St. Paul who were told to arrest or harass Iraq war veterans who were protesting against the war, and they refused to do it. You know, and that's the kind of patriotism I'm talking about. I'm getting emails and calls from police officers who are starting to go on the record disclosing that they're getting orders from Homeland Security that they do not want to follow. You know, I'm hearing from, you know, the brother of one of these soldiers from the 1st Brigade saying, you know, what do we do to support our military who don't want to do this? You know, those kinds of patriots. Everything from, you know, I mean, military people, you know, like Major Antoon, who's a source of mine, who's going on the record saying, you know, inviting other members of the military to break ranks and to say, no, that they won't go along with it, to stand up for the rule of law. And by the way, this is a transpartisan issue. I'm hearing from as many conservatives and libertarians as liberals, because this is not about left or right. This is about what we cherish as Americans.
So we're about to have an election, obviously, and record voter turnout is expected. But you have really argued that Americans have a much broader civic obligation than simply voting. And I was hoping you could talk about what you see as our obligations.
Sure. And that's a great question. It's a wonderful question. So I thought that it was just the last 8 years that this cabal of criminals has set about subverting the Constitution so aggressively and disenfranchising the people. But, you know, when I went around the country talking about the end of America last fall, many people rightly said, okay, Naomi, you're freaking us out. You know, we recognize that this is happening, but what do we do about it? And so, for Give Me Liberty, which is the sequel, I went back to the founders, and I don't just mean the founders were all familiar with, the, you know, sort of propertied white men whose names we know. I mean, that whole founding generation that we're really not taught about in our history books, ordinary people who were farmers and artisans and you know, working people, washerwomen, enslaved African Americans, all of whom were captivated by this vision of liberty and who moved forward this extraordinary ideal that we're supposed to receive, especially at a time like this when we need to kind of call on this psychological ideal to fight back with. And what I discovered is that what we're supposed to do as Americans is much, much bigger and much, much deeper and braver than the propaganda we get about our task as citizens. And I discovered that it's not just the last 8 years, it's actually for 30 years, really since the Reagan era, there has been this systematic propagandizing of us as citizens to think that our role is smaller and smaller and smaller than it's supposed to be. You know, so that finally we think, well, we're doing what we're supposed to do as citizens if we vote and if we send an email to our representatives. But this is after a 30-year bombardment of what I call fake patriotism to get us to support what I've discovered is a fake democracy compared to what it's supposed to be. We're not taught that, you know, the founders, the founding generation, didn't intend for us to leave the task of leading the nation to politicians. They intended for us to do it. And they didn't mean for us to hand over the debates and the deliberation to pundits on Fox News or CNN or to me and Catherine, right? They intended for you guys to do it, to be the ones leading the debates and the deliberation hammering out the policy outcomes for your communities and for the nation. And they didn't intend for us to hand over the task of defending the Constitution to the constitutional scholars. They intended each and every one of us to stand up for the Constitution. I mean, there's all this amazing stuff that I didn't know, even though I was blessed with a very good education. We all know life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right, from the Declaration of Independence. And we're taught that that kind of means, you know, you shop at Talbots, I'll shop at, you know, Victoria's Secret, and we'll leave each other alone, it's fine. You be a goth, I'll be a soccer mom, it's fine, we'll get along. First of all, that's not even what happiness meant in the 18th century. It meant...
It didn't mean consumerism.
It didn't even mean personal satisfaction. It meant using your faculties to their highest power in a context of freedom to serve the greatest good. But quite apart from that kind of mind-blowing thing, the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, Mrs. Smith never taught you this in eighth grade. You know, it is a personal contract between you and the United States of America for you to be a revolutionary standing up against oppression and tyranny absolutely everywhere you see it, including in the form of your own government, especially in the form of your own government. So we're not, you know, that's like erased. And so I discovered that, you know, our mandate is supposed to be vast. Like the First Amendment is supposed to give us vast powers of assembly and vast freedom of speech, right? All over the country, you know, students are being raised for free speech plazas, these tiny little postage-sized spaces on college campuses. And even when you protest now in America, the kind of protest you're allowed to have now is by definition sterile, and it can't change anything. Legal protest in America cannot change anything. I've got a whole chapter on protest. Why, when you go to march, you feel like this didn't make a difference? Because it didn't. Why? Because 30 years of a clever, sneaky tactic of over-permitticization means that if you're engaged in a legal protest, by definition, it's not going to disrupt anything. And the great protests, the ones that always, always transform history, brought down the Berlin Wall, liberated the Baltic states from the Soviet Union, restored people power, you know, created and sustained the civil rights movement, they bring everything to a halt. They stop traffic, right? They stop business as usual. That kind of protest is illegal in America today. So our mandate is vast. And so, like, having read Jefferson and being all on fire with these ordinary founders, I went out, you know, there's this one section where I go out to try to use all my powers that I'm supposed to have as a citizen. So I go out and, you know, try to get a friend to run for Senate in Virginia, and I find that two clicks into the process, the information we need is in Latin. You know, it's like so bureaucraties, legalese, it is impenetrable, and there's no translation. On purpose, I believe. Because all over, you know, city council websites, state websites, there's the same kind of block to ordinary citizens engaging in the process. I try to hold a rally for the Constitution in Union Square. I'm out there with my bullhorn. I discover that using a bullhorn in Union Square is illegal. Right? It's illegal. I think about registering my neighbors as voters, and I discover that I'm risking a $5,000 fine from organizations that are determined to suppress this kind of citizen action. Again and again, I get thwarted with sort of these barriers, fake democracy, which I'm convinced have been put in place by vested interests who were freaked out by the 60s and 70s, freaked out by citizens actually changing things, and have been put in place to kind of pacify us and get us to kind of get frustrated and wash our hands of it and abandon our seat at the table, let alone our leadership role. And in this whole journey, the one place where I thought, I want to serve my country, the one place where they welcomed me with open arms, made the process supportive, transparent, easy to understand, was when I walked into an Army recruiting center to see how I could serve in the war in Iraq.
So what are some of the things that you think that can be done to dismantle these barriers to civic participation? I mean, why do you think that we're complacent and accept the idea that voting is our only obligation?
Well, it's not just our fault, although some of it is our fault. Why are we complacent? I think we intuit that this maze exists. You know, it's just so heartbreaking. It's like, I really think sometimes, Catherine, I think nations are like families. And when there's some really deep dysfunction, some really horrible, shameful secret in a family, you know, it's family systems theory is that people kind of find a way to like not look at it. And I think the fact is that on some deep level, we know that there is a kind of toxic, horrible, shameful secret, which is that this democracy that we're told is the greatest on earth is corrupted at the core in terms of our own participation. And rather than beating our heads against a wall or facing the heartbreak of this, we kind of defend ourselves with cynicism and then turn to reality shows and internet shopping, understandably, right? I mean, I remember when when I'd been going through this excruciating process of, it was like a horror film. You know, those horror films where you sort of look under every rock and, you know, there's something awful under every rock. I was like clicking on, wait, the website of the Atlanta City Council. No, it's here. You know, and then the website of the, you know, Shasta County, California, it's here. You know, and it, like everywhere I was looking, it was like these stumbling blocks, these barriers, these kind of Potemkin democracy processes. And I remember there's this moment where I was like, sitting on the floor at Newark Airport opposite a, you know, the country's best yogurt stand, like weeping because I was so heartbroken that this beautiful, beautiful thing that I'd been raised to believe was intact. Anyone can become president, greatest democracy on earth, was riddled with corruption. So I think part of it is that we can't bear it because also we don't know what to do about it. And it wasn't until I went to the end of this journey where I consulted a bunch of experts, you know, leaders in these various fields about how do we fix this, that I actually began to have some hope because there are these 55 action steps at the end of the book of concretely how we fix it, how we root out the corruption, how we reestablish ourselves as leaders of a clean, you know, detoxified democracy.
One of those suggestions is that we make voting mandatory like they have in Australia. And I wonder what you think that would achieve and how we could make that happen and why we should.
Right. What do you think it won't achieve?
I'm not sure. I just wonder, you know, won't some people see it as, you know, this thing being imposed upon them? And shouldn't we be trying to encourage people to just vote because they want to and they feel inspired to?
I mean, do we encourage people to pay taxes because they want to?
Fair enough.
I mean, I guess I've become such a kind of democracy radical that it kind of amazes me that we're still in a place where we're having a question like, is it bad to compel people to serve as citizen leaders in this incredibly minimal way? You know, I mean, we compel people to do so many awful, awful things every day. We compel people to subjugate themselves to NSA spying on their personal conversations. You know, we compel people to accept a Congress that spends half its day raising money, you know, and is unable to listen to the will of the people. So, no, I think it's on balance. There are many countries around the world where voting is mandatory, and I mean, they have really high voter turnout, and the, you know, the electoral outcomes reflect the will of the people, which is good. I found that the barriers, it's extraordinary. You know, we're really told, or until recently we all believed this is like the strongest democracy on earth. It's nonsense. It's extraordinary. Their democracy is so much stronger than ours. It's shocking to me. Jimmy Carter, someone was asking Jimmy Carter of the Carter Center if they would come monitor the U.S. vote, you know, because they monitor the votes all over the world to make sure they're transparent and accountable. He said that our system is so dysfunctional that it doesn't qualify to the level that would allow them to monitor the vote. You know, I have this great, I think it's a great idea. There's Canada. They have really clean, fantastic voting systems. I was just in Canada, and you're in a mall. You're shopping in a mall, and there's this giant, like, it's the size of the lower floor of Macy's, you know, in the mall. And it's the voting area in the mall. You don't even have to go to some god-awful, you know, post office thing or, you know, schoolyard.
Garage,
exactly. And, you know, it's comfortable, and there's lots of space, and it's not like in the U.S. It's like we are the I don't know what it's like we're in the developing world in terms of our apparatus for democracy. It's like, how skunky is the voting experience in America? I mean, maybe not in California, but in New York? Oh my God. You know, and you're standing in line for hours, and if you're in a poor neighborhood, a low-income neighborhood, there aren't enough booths, you're there for days, you know, and now the Republicans are sending you letters saying they'll arrest you, you know, if you've got any, you know, and then now if your name doesn't match, I mean, oh my God. And in Canada, you waltz in, they give you tea, practically, you know, and it's all in, like, Aboriginal languages if you're Aboriginal, and it's in, you know, Eskimo languages if you're Eskimo, or, oh, I'm sorry, that is Aboriginal, I'm sorry. It's like keeping up with, but... You know, whatever it is you need, it's there. Anyway, the Royal Electoral Commission in Canada is nonpartisan. They're lifetime civil servants. They don't have a dog in this fight. In Canada, everyone trusts them. Let's invite the Royal Canadian Elections Commission to monitor our vote.
Another suggestion you have is that we should have a national referendum process, sort of like we have the proposition process in California. And can you talk about... You know, why you think we should have that?
Sure. Now, I grew up in California, and I witnessed firsthand, you know, how passionate people can get about the initiative and referenda system and how stupid it can be, right? Because crazy people want to pass laws inflicting their craziness on other people. Am I right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. And probably California is a showcase for this, right? Sometimes. On the other hand... I also watched again and again in California how the craziest of the crazy people were kind of beaten back by sanity and sane people. So on balance, you basically, you know, when you've got this citizen engagement, on balance, you correct its excesses. So 24 states around the country have initiative and referenda systems. And these are a result of the progressive era, a result of wanting to empower the people. Now, as you know better than I, in California... lobbyists for these special interests can try to sort of fund the initiative system and fund ads and so on. But really, even if that's the case, it's citizens being lobbied. And I've come to the absolute conclusion that we are better off when citizens are being lobbied and citizens are writing and passing the laws than if special interests have a stranglehold on Congress and citizens have no role. So
can't citizens also use the referendum or proposition system to limit other citizens' rights? I mean, in California, we famously now have this proposition which would remove, gay and lesbian citizens' right to marry, which our somewhat conservative state Supreme Court just allowed, you know, sort of kicking and screaming. And so here we have an instance where our proposition system would limit people's freedoms.
You're right. And that is the risk that you take with broadening the initiative and referendum system. But let me turn your attention to Europe, okay, for a moment. All of the EU countries have national referenda. And Switzerland has had national referenda for 600 years. Now, Switzerland, whatever you think about their neutrality, they have never fought a war the people didn't want to fight. All right? Now, let's go to the U.S., President Lincoln wanted to have a national referendum on slavery. And the danger, of course, and this is the tension between a Republican and a democracy, right? The danger, of course, is with a national referendum or a statewide referendum, the danger is that a majority will limit the rights of a minority. And that's why you need these checks and balances to be in place, obviously. But I do trust over, 30, 40 years of watching this process in California and all over the country operate, if you get bad laws, the citizens can persuade each other to make the laws better. And again, no system we're going to have is perfect. And there is that danger with the initiative and referendum process. However, listen to me about the following issues. There are some things we desperately need that we are never going to have with a corrupted Congress in the pockets of special interests. And we're not going to survive without them. One of them, global warming. We're going to be inundated. Our kids won't have a planet unless we cap emissions. Like now, right? So the oil industry, they are never going to let us cap emissions. Ever, ever, ever. Most Americans want to cap emissions. Most Americans want to have investment in alternative energy and stop global warming. Overnight. with a national referendum, you could cap emissions. The Iraq War, 70% of Americans want to end the war. Do you know anyone who feels that they have a voice in ending this goddamn war? All right? So overnight, with a national referendum, you could end the war and bring our brave men and women home. And, you know, the last example is campaign finance reform, real campaign finance reform. The people who are in bed with each other on Capitol Hill have no incentive to listen to the people. I mean, I have this from the sources. They want to. They're good public servants. But literally, we don't have a seat at the table that is powerful enough to counter these special interests right now. I've given you tactics in the book, like forming what I call democracy commando teams, to leverage your power, to even out the special interests' power. But a national referendum, the danger is that crazy people will become a majority, and then we'll need to lobby and organize and persuade our fellow citizens not to be crazy. But I personally find that much less scary than the prospect of being further and further crowded out of voice, you know, forever. So I rest my trust with the people.
Let's talk a little more specifically about this election. You've written that Alaska's Governor Sarah Palin, the Republican vice presidential candidate, is, quote, the designated muse of the coming police state. Can you describe what exactly you mean by that?
Yeah. Oh, boy, I sure can. And I have to say, we were just talking earlier in the green room about how I was lured onto Fox News earlier this afternoon. Oh, you know, let's chat about Hillary. And they, like, ambushed me with confrontation about this piece I wrote about Sarah Palin. But that's fair. I mean, those are the good old days when, you know, in a democracy when all we did was yell at each other and not, like, face down tanks in the street. But Sarah Palin, here's my analysis. Okay, I started noticing that she was carrying water for policies that were not John McCain's. In other words, John McCain wrote eloquently in Newsweek in 2005 before he reversed position against the torture of prisoners. He was a prisoner of war. Sarah Palin mocked Barack Obama for wanting to restore basic rights to prisoners. That's not John McCain's position. Sarah Palin lied to the American people with Bush's lie connecting 9/11 to Iraq. That's not John McCain's lie. And I started to notice that she was surrounded by Rove aides, Rove speechwriters, Bush speechwriters. Even the stylist who did, you know, Catherine Harris, right, is styling Sarah Palin. So my analysis went like this. This is a difficult thing to talk about, but we have to. McCain's age and his illness has an actuarial projected survival rate of 2 to 4 years. Okay. So in a closing society, you often see that the cabal in power, they like to hold elections. Dictators all over the world hold elections. They love elections. They just make sure that the elections are corrupted and that their own guy or gal gets in. And often they'll choose a telegenic, not very bright figurehead to be the front person for the same gang of thieves that maintains power. So my read is that they're counting on a Palin presidency sooner if not later, perhaps a decade of a Palin presidency in which she's the front for Rove and Cheney and Halliburton to remain writing the laws of the United States, and that in that process they will really solidify and build up the foundations of the police state that they've begun. If, God forbid, that happens, we're really looking at the end of elections, free elections in America, for this simple reason. In a true surveillance state, which we now have, the regime in power can read the opposition's strategy memos and speeches while they're still in a computer. So how are you ever going to have a real election subsequent to that, unless you roll back these FISA violations, which you're not going to do under a Palin presidency?
So let's talk about the possibility of a Barack Obama presidency. Do you think that an Obama presidency would mean the end of some of or all of these incursions on our freedoms that you're decrying? And sort of why or why not?
Right. Totally not, Catherine. I'm sorry to tell you. Here's what we have to do. You know, I kept discovering in the research I did for Give Me Liberty that America is not a place. And it's not even a system of government. Properly understood, it's a state of mind. And it's a condition of inner liberty. And by the way, this is what people around the world envy us for. It's not our standard of living, though that's nice. It's this state of inner freedom. So we've fallen into habits of mind that are not American. in this sense. And one of them is this habit of passivity about leadership, that John McCain will solve the problem, or Barack Obama will solve the problem, or some strong man or woman will, you know, ride in on a white horse and solve the problem. Barack Obama, if by some miracle he survives election, I don't mean literally, God forbid, what I mean is if there's actually transparent, uncorrupted, accountable election process and he takes power on Inauguration Day, he, first of all, is inheriting these monstrous laws. And history shows that, and the founders knew this, that the best intentioned leader never gives back power and can almost never resist the temptation to abuse these powers. And the founders knew that, and that's why they set up this system of checks and balances. So just think about it. Like, I've worked on two presidential campaigns. I didn't advise Bill Clinton, by the way. I worked informally with Dick Morris, who was advising Bill Clinton. But what I learned firsthand is that democracy is really, really hard. It is really hard work to get more than half of the people to vote for you. All right? And so given that, if you've got the wherewithal to intimidate a group of Republican protesters or to threaten Matt Drudge with being named an enemy combatant and locked up for 3 years in a Navy brig, or to, you know, do a little eavesdropping on your Republican opposition in Congress so that you can leverage their vulnerabilities, their addictions, their bisexuality, their adulteries, their conversations with their accountants. All of us have secrets, right? All of which are now in the hands of the opposition with wiretapping. You would have to be superhuman or a masochist to choose real democratic processes. There's another reason we can't leave it to him. A lot of money is being made in shredding the Constitution of the United States. Why was all this set in motion? It's not just a naked evil power grab, though I think these people are genuinely evil. It's because in the wake of the Cold War, the third of the economy that was manufacturing Cold War weapon systems was looking at a declining market share. They needed a new global enemy. So there is an incentive, an economic incentive, to hype an eternal, endless war on terror, right? Because these corporations, the Boeings and the Raytheons, have switched from Cold War weapon systems to surveillance and security technologies. And their lobbyists are sitting down with Homeland Security and writing the laws. Why did Barack Obama, who has spoken passionately, he's a constitutional lawyer, you know, he's spoken passionately about sustaining the Constitution. He caved on FISA. Why? AT&T makes a ton of money building up a surveillance society where the enemy is us. You know, Wall Street is trading on Chinese police state shares, right? This is the future, unless there's a citizens' movement, us, millions of Americans, transpartisan movement, and you can join it at MyAmericaProject.org, we're building this movement, to push back, to be the interest group for the Constitution. Again and again, I heard Al Gore, who was a decent guy, who wanted to give people good policies. You know, he wanted to give women decent work family policies. Every mom and dad here knows how great that would be. And he couldn't, because the chambers of commerce were organized and they didn't want it because it's expensive, but moms weren't organized. So he wanted to do it, but he couldn't say to the chambers of commerce, sorry, my hands are tied. There are 30 million American moms and dads in this lobby who are holding my feet to the fire. We have abdicated. It's up to us to restore the Constitution. And there's this 10-point legislative agenda you can look at, which will actually do it. But he's not going to pass it if we don't force him to.
In this election season, it really seems like fears about the economy have replaced fears about terrorism in the national conversation. And I'd like you to talk about what you think is not being discussed, because we're talking only about the economy in this kind of fear-driven way.
What do you mean, Catherine? What do you mean?
Well, what issues do you think are being, you know, covered over on the campaign trail or left behind because there's now so much focus on the economy?
Well, I have to say, I think it's very, very interesting, when there wasn't an economic crisis, how the Bush White House was able to hype and spin and manipulate many narratives about imminent terrorist attacks that really vanished when charges were actually brought against these individuals, many of whom were kind of hapless, you know, many of whom were innocent, including 65% of the people in Guantanamo who are still languishing, you know, in legal no man's land, according to a Seton Hall study. But I think obviously, I mean, it seems obvious to me, it's mind-blowing to me that you get these national debates, these presidential debates, and a lot of ground is covered, but in a time where many Americans that I meet across the political spectrum are absolutely heartbroken, if not petrified, watching the implosion of their liberties, there's not one question about wiretapping. There's not one question about torture. There's not one question about, you know, preemptive detention of citizens at the RNC who are sitting around minding their own business, or the arrest of journalists. There's not one question about what are you going to do to restore the Constitution. Does that seem bizarre to you?
But do you think that the sort of unstable economic climate is going to make people less likely to stand up for those freedoms? You know, the fear of losing your own job makes you less worried about losing your civil liberties. And I'll also point out that now would be a great time for people to start lining up to ask their own questions of Naomi Wolf in 5 minutes. The microphone's right there.
Oh, I see what you mean. That's a very interesting question. I kind of flip it around. You know, this blueprint is very predictive, as I've said. And so last fall, not because I'm so smart, but because the blueprint is so predictive, I was saying the months and weeks leading up to an election in a closing society are unstable. You're likely to see hyped threats, emergencies, crises, and provocations. Right? And so what I was really interested in, and again, the National Socialists used economic instability to freak people out, and then they promised to restore order. Same thing with Mussolini. I was interested in the president's language in his speech a week and a half ago about the economic implosion. The markets were plummeting, and he goes on television, and he says, "This is really scary. It's going to get scarier and scarier. It's going to get worse and worse and worse, and it's probably going to come to your neighborhood and to a bank near you." Remember that speech? So if you're the president of the United States of America, you know, is this language designed to calm markets and stabilize jittery investors, or is it language designed to whip further up emotions and a sense of crisis? So I definitely think that the market implosion has been used by this White House as a pretext for, and this is why I'm worried about the deployment of the First Brigade. It's very easy to imagine from the historical record, oh my God, crisis, emergency, instability, national emergency, we've got to restore public order by deploying the First Brigade. Or many other variations on the theme. Bloomberg is saying, God forbid, you know, I mean, he's a great mayor, but God forbid this becomes precedent in our democracy. He wants a third term. Why? Economic instability, emergency, right? This is classic dictator power grab. Instability, crisis, it's not safe. Mussolini did it, Hitler did it, Musharraf did it. You know, so I don't like that. And will it make people more inclined to accept crackdowns on liberty? Paradoxically, people can be quite liberated by economic instability to realize what's really precious in their lives. And I'm not at all sure that economic vulnerability will leave Americans more silent. I mean, they were pretty damn silent when the Dow was very strong.
We've talked about a couple of ways that people can get more involved, but could you mention a few more of the, you know, the ways that you really think people can become more politically active?
Sure. Well, let's see, some of my favorites. And let me say again, I'm throwing out some ideas and I give you these 55 steps in the book, but what I really hope you'll take away with you is the notion that the really great ideas are the ones that you guys come up with. You know, that it's all of our job to draw in that creativity, that use our knowledge base, our experience base, our network of friends and family to think, oh my God, this is what I can do for my country. This is what I can do to restore the republic, right? Because that's the wealth of the nation. That's what the founders really intended. But my set goes like this. My favorite is these democracy commando teams that I describe. This was an idea given to me by Curtis Ellis, who's my source on Capitol Hill, who basically kind of shows how the sausage is made and shows that basically when you call and complain to your congressperson, if you haven't voted, they know who you are. And if they, I mean, meaning if you haven't voted in the congressional election, they don't care what you say, you know, because you're not useful to them. But if you vote, and more important, if you can show them that you've registered 20 or 30 people to vote in the congressional elections, not just the presidential, and then you show them that you're helping in certain ways during their election cycle, paradoxically, then when you call, he said it's like a nuclear bomb. You know, that you've got, and I said 20 or 30 people, he said absolutely, that it gets down in some precincts to 5 people, and that you're gold if you do this, and you can ask for the moon, and you have more power than the special interests. Why? They're in hock to these special interests for $5,000 for an ad to persuade you and 20 of your friends. So if you can deliver yourself and 20 of your friends, you know, they don't need the special, you know, the guys with the check. Get it? All right. So if you form these democracy clubs, it's not just this, but every month you, you know, build a website to keep an eye on what your, you know, city council is doing. You let people know what's coming up for votes. I mean, unbelievable in America. With our technology, we've got, like, there's a video on YouTube that's live coverage of an intersection on Martha's Vineyard, right? But when you go to Congress's website, you can't find out what they're voting on. You know? And if you can, it's not even in English, right? It's not even in real time. So you're lucky if you get an email from some random organization telling you what's going on in the dark. And then you send your stupid little email, and it's like, and you feel totally, you know, it's like a bad one night stand. You feel like, is this all there is? You know? Is he never going to call? You know? Or wait a minute, if it's a bad one night stand, you don't even want him to call, but...
On that,
you know,
note...
No, Catherine, I just need to end this. And so instead, say I want to set up this system where you, if you send in your email, people who are willing to disclose their emails, you find out if you're the only one in America who it wants to end the Iraq War, if you're one of 70 million people, because then you have some power. So that's one of my favorites, and others are become the media yourself. You know, you're right to complain about the media, it sucks, but stop complaining, go be the media. Right? So I teach you how to write the op-eds yourselves, how to submit them, how to do radio, how to do television, how to leak to a reporter, how to frame the issues, how to write the feature stories, you know, how to blog, how to do viral videos, become the media. And other favorites are write your own legislation, document government abuses, and start your own political movement.
Okay, so right now... we're going to ask you to become the media.
Thank you.
As a reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's In Forum program, and tonight we're talking with Naomi Wolf. Now we're going to questions from the audience, sir.
Hi.
There it is. Okay. Out of 1,000 possible questions, getting back to the national referendum, and I believe when you spoke last night in Berkeley, you described this as a way to ignite maybe for the first time in the country, a deliberative democracy.
Right.
I'm curious how we do that, well, number one, on a scale of a country of 300 million plus people.
Right.
And number two, perhaps even more important, when we're lacking certain pieces of infrastructure that I see as important, perhaps the most important, what I imagine is present in Switzerland and other countries of Northern Europe and so on, a functioning public education system
right.
that trains people in rigorous critical thinking so that they know the difference between being informed and being propagandized.
Right.
I think the Prop 8 experience here in California is a fine example of how not to do it when simple outright lies are going over the airwaves, and there really isn't a whole lot of pushback on it right now.
Right. Well, I totally hear what you're saying. These are great. That's a great question. And for those of you who are not sure what the speaker means, there is a part of the book that I devote to a movement that I wasn't familiar with before called deliberative democracy. And I should have remembered to tell you why it's worth taking the risk with a national referendum, provided you add deliberative democracy to it. Deliberative democracy is a practice that some people like Bruce Ackerman at Yale have developed, where you get the citizens of a neighborhood or a town or a city together in a very structured way to deliberate among themselves on the issues that they're going to be voting on. And he actually proposes a 2-day deliberation day period before every election. And it's a process where you really spend a whole day as citizens debating with deliberating, not debating oppositionally, deliberating with one another across party lines, economic lines, racial lines, about the issues and being educated about the issues, posing your questions to representatives of the candidates, right? So it's not just Tom Brokaw and the candidates and these three citizens in a studio. It's everybody at a grassroots level. And then what these studies of this process find is that citizens become, their level of insight into the issue goes way up. Their willingness to take ownership of solutions goes way up. Like, you know, they're willing to like pay more for electricity if it means, you know, protecting the environment in certain ways. And that apparently leaders emerge from every class and economic background in the deliberative process. Citizens inform each other. And what blows me away about the potential of this, too, is that right now I've witnessed that we're being pushed into these two camps, right and left, are the labels, and their deep vested interests, whether it's think tanks or pundits or news organizations, devoted to making sure we never talk to each other face to face and demonize each other, okay? And so deliberative democracy helps us get past that, back to the place where we're working with people we disagree with face to face, which is, I can tell you, a better way to make better policy. So to your point of why can we risk this given how terrible our educational system is, you're right about that. And when you're on fire with the founder's ideal, you start to see things like, oh my God, we've got, you know, public education is not expendable, right? And a free press is not expendable. And even things like bilingual education is not such a good idea, right? In other words, it's a good idea to have people be bilingual, but you don't ever want ghettoizing of citizens. You want people to be able to communicate and deliberate in a single language. I guess the answer is yes, yes, yes. I don't just want a national referendum. I want everyone to be so on fire about restoring and raising up the level of our republic to maybe a higher point than it's ever been that we won't tolerate crumbling public schools and we won't tolerate a consolidated media under corporate control, and we, you know, don't accept the fact that half of our kids no longer are given civics education. So one out of every two college freshmen doesn't know what the system is, let alone how to defend it. So my hope is that if we are all on fire in this way, we provide all of these institutions. We don't tolerate the crumbling of them. Yeah. Thank you. Where's my applause? Thank you. Thank you.
Hey. Okay. So I completely agree that education and a strong media is a fundamental pillar of democracy. But as an aspiring journalist, I'm really concerned with the idea of consumer sovereignty versus political sovereignty.
Huh.
And I get really disillusioned with the sort of dejected apathy of people my age. And I wonder, how do we get to a point where people actually are on fire about these issues and actually do get inspired to become part of this? Because what I see often is just sort of a sense of powerlessness.
Yeah.
How do we incite people to actually take action in the first place?
How do we incite them to take action? Well, that is the question. And don't go away. I think that, you know, I'm going to say this all night. I think you are the answer. What I've found is that it takes one person in a group of 10 or 20 friends who won't get apathetic and who role models, well, I'm going to start this. I'm going to find a solution. I'm going to go door to door. I'm going to speak passionately to my friends. I'm going to register voters. I'm going to show up and document the vote. I'm going to be excited. I'm going to share what I'm reading. And it's tiring to assume that role of leader, but that's the answer. I've also found that, how can I put this? When I try to persuade people to take action and I approach it from an intellectual point of view, often I don't make headway, especially if I'm talking to people from another world or another demographic. But I've found, and I can't really explain this, it's a matter of faith or kind of intuition or personal experience, that when I approach people with an open heart and a sense of concern for their well-being and an attitude of sincerity, even when I don't have the right words or the best strategy, people do open up and listen energizing communication takes place. Do you all know what I'm talking about? So it's very hard to explain how that works, but I think the more we open our hearts to one another and reach out to one another in this spirit of caring about one another as citizens, the more strength we'll find from each other and the more creativity comes into what we build. Yeah. Thank you.
Hello. I'd just like to thank you for your caring, your fighting, your passion.
Thank you.
Sometimes I've heard about microchips put in humans, and someone has expressed that to do things on the internet, to communicate about things that certain governments might not want, would be dangerous, so they don't do anything. And they're surveying, is it on landlines or just cell phones?
So is your question, what's the level of surveillance? Is that your question?
Yeah, and can you say something about these things?
I mean, I know that there are confirmed facts and then there are rumors out there. And, I know that there are people who are freaked out by the confirmed facts that also circulate rumors. As far as I know, the whole microchip thing is just a rumor. I have no documentation of that. But the reality is bad enough. The NSA, I mean, there's a new book coming out by Bamford. I forgot his first name. Thank you. About the NSA, about NSA surveillance. I mean, there was just a story, and it vanished the way so many of these stories do, on CNN, about the fact that, the NSA was wiretapping intimate conversations between service members and their girlfriends or wives, boyfriends or husbands at home, and transcribing them. And then when the transcriber said, I don't want to do this, the NSA said, it's your orders to do it. These people are sick, honestly. So there's a very high level of surveillance. Most activists that I know assume that they could be being listened to. It's like East Germany in the sense that people knew the Stasi existed. They knew some people had files. So everyone acted like they might be under surveillance. That's how surveillance works. After the Berlin Wall fell, only 10% actually had a file. But it doesn't matter. All you need to do to feel inhibited is to know there's this surveillance. I've started to say this in public because John Perkins, who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, told me that the safest thing for me to do is keep saying these things in public. But it used to be that I was just on the watch list, and those were the good old days, the quadruple S security threat mark on my boarding pass. But now my mail arrives ripped open, just ripped open. As far as I know, nothing's missing except my tax returns vanished, registered mail, and other correspondence is just not arriving. But stuff arrives ripped open, and I show it to the post office, and they're like, this isn't possible. The machines can't do this. I file a police report. They're taking it very seriously. Other activists like Mark Crispin Miller have experienced the same kind of mail tampering. And other activists are experiencing much more serious things like people breaking into their homes or apartments and nothing taken. So this is the tipping point of a police state, because what happens is, right now it's only some people you may have heard of, but at a certain point, critical mass is reached where it's someone you know had their apartment broken into, or someone you know has their mail opened, or someone it gets a national security letter, and then a society can close down even without a coup with headlines. So it's broad, and the answer is with us. We have to get in our hearts that founders' anger. How dare they? How dare they surveil American citizens? How dare they surveil anyone? We stand for liberty. We won't tolerate it. But history really shows that only when people refuse to tolerate it do they have a chance against this kind of oppression. Yeah.
You mentioned
I'm sorry, there's so many people behind you. We can talk when we're signing. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. I'll make a challenge to your radicalism. You say
Please.
You're willing to arrest the president, but what would you do about the Israeli lobby? What would you do about a lobby that's gotten us into war, that provides surveillance to AT&T? I doubt most people here know that AT&T outsources much of its network to Amdocs, an Israeli company.
Really?
When you ride, yes. And I've even said that at the Commonwealth Club before, and you can look it up on the web.
All right.
You will find it is an absolute literal truth.
Okay. So let me answer your question because there's so many people behind you.
Right.
All right. So first of all, thank you for your challenge. It doesn't scare me. We should be challenging each other, you know, respectfully. That's what a democracy should be doing. Your question is very well grounded. I'm Jewish, so I get to say this. The Israel lobby is a very negative, has a very negative effect on U.S. foreign policy, in my judgment, and that of many progressive Jews. And that's why I'm really glad that there's J Street, which is a new lobby for peace, civil society, and justice in the Middle East, and in support of Palestinian rights and self-determination. And they're trying to counter the influence of the Israel lobby. I also want to say that the Israel lobby's hawkishness is sometimes in violation of what many mainstream Israelis wish, and they don't feel that it supports their goals or stable, peaceful Israel. So you're quite right to bring it up. Thank you. And I speak out against it. All right. And I'm glad you did, too.
I've heard you mention democracy quite a bit and the Constitution and that you would like to see the Constitution restored. But if you really read the Constitution, we are actually
a constitutional republic.
If you had democracy, people like me that actually don't, agree with a lot of what you say and maybe what a lot of people say here, my rights would not be there. But if you went strictly by the Constitution, I could retain my rights and you could retain your rights and we'd all be able to do just fine. But if you bring people into small groups like what you're advocating and what a lot of the, like the Ford Foundation, a lot of these other large multinational corporations are advocating, that's when you start getting into fascism. So I just want to say I do disagree with you on that point and that the stranglehold that the two-party system has where you have a right gatekeepers and left gatekeepers, both actually on the same side behind the scenes, that's the real problem. We need to get away from them and start looking at people like Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich and people that really care about the Constitution and want to get rid of the Fed,
yeah,
which is economic control, and want to get rid of globalism.
All right, so thank you, and don't go away. You've said some very important things. Thank you. Don't go away. Don't go away. We have to get out of this habit of, like, leaving the discussion to the people on the podium. You know, you're the expert. All of you are the experts in what you bring, all right? So, first of all, how many Ron Paul supporters are there here? All right, all right. And Dennis Kucinich supporters? Wonderful. And so what's so beautiful about what we can create is that both these groups probably have different policy outcomes that they're hoping for, but their core values are so in alignment, and there's such a rich set of relationships and such a powerful movement we can create by building these partnerships together, right? I mean, we've so much is set to divide us, but these core values really unite us. So what you've said is right. Those challenges are right. Many people, especially from the Ron Paul community, rightly point out that when I say democracy, I'm using language loosely. You're quite right that, strictly speaking, we are a constitutional republic. Now, the founders did provide for us to amend the Constitution, which is what I'm calling for us to make use of in, for instance, a limited national referendum.
I just want to point out that George Bush loves the word democracy, and so does his buddy Bill Clinton.
So you're right to remind us that the beauty of our system is that it is a constitutional republic. There isn't, the repression of minority groups, as you say. You're also right, and I have to give a shout out to the Ron Paul community for educating me. I've evolved on this. You are right that the two-party system suppresses citizen leadership.
That's the problem.
Okay, but bear with me. All right. I don't agree that they're the same. It's my experience that the two parties are owned by different interests and enthralled to different interests. However, I do agree with you that it's crazy that, for instance, the presidential debates, who invented this, are restricted to the two major candidates. That's crazy. The founders didn't even, establish parties, political parties, right? And I agree with you that we need to support other leaders like Ron Paul, Dennis Kucinich, many, many alternatives to the two-party system. And I also admire the Ron Paul community because, while we on the left have been whining, they've been organizing and learning how to use the political process to break open the political process to get in there and change things.
Can I make one more comment?
No, you can't because there are like three people behind you. But round of applause, please. Thank you. The other thing I love that I hope to see more and more of is, we've lost this habit of debate and deliberation among ourselves, and I really love it when Americans bravely stand up in a room full of people who might not agree with them and speak from their heart about what's true for them, and it's a great service to all of us. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
One of the things we're taught in this country from a very early age is to equate capitalism with democracy mm-hmm. and socialism with tyranny.
Interesting.
I'm wondering what your views on these relationships are.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, you know, history certainly shows that fascism and capitalism can live very happily together. In fact, Nazi Germany, all kinds of corporations, including IBM and Krupps and Thyssen, thrived economically with the kind of enforcement of, you know, a suppressed civil society that fascism provided for them. In fact, George Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, made his family fortune in collaboration with Nazi Germany. And by the way, did you know that he was part of an attempted coup against the United States of America? Some of you do know that. Against FDR, he and Prescott Bush and a number of other top leaders of industry admired Mussolini and Hitler and wanted to see something like that in the U.S. And they sent an agent to to Germany and Italy to study how those people toppled society. And they were going to mobilize the veterans, 500,000 veterans, to be a kind of black shirt group to move against FDR. And Smedley Darlington Butler exposed this coup. It's in the congressional record. But Bush's grandpa tried to engineer a fascist coup. I do believe in the historical moment that we're in that only vigorous democracy can contain and challenge global capitalism and its excesses now. And that's what you see in strong democracies that have tempered capitalism, like Norway, Sweden. These are countries where vigorous capitalism is tempered by vigorous democracy, and it's really good for people.
That's all the questions we have time for. Let's give a big hand to
Naomi
Wolf for her thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
All right. Thank you.